All right, we're going to wrap up just one chapter. That is incorrect. It's chapter 39, I believe, is where we are. I didn't update this slide. Of course, Jeremiah, we've talked about, had a very difficult ministry. And God told him this, and I take some encouragement about this. Jeremiah, when called, said, "Lord, you've called the wrong guy. I'm too young, I'm too inexperienced." And God said, "Before you were even formed in your mother's womb, I had this job for you to do." So the point is this. God knew the situation, and God put Jeremiah there in Jerusalem at this point in time, 606 B.C., for this particular job, and he did it on purpose. Didn't catch God by surprise. So as we sit here and we look around the world and we see what's going on in our own country, we've seen the theft of an election in 2020. We've seen encroachments into our liberty and the early onset of tyranny. God, this didn't take the Lord by surprise. We are here as mostly white Christians in Edmond, Oklahoma in 2021 on purpose. God has us here for this time, for this reason. So we will be faithful to respond to what God has called us to do. Now, Jeremiah preached for 40 years, and we would say it was a miserable failure as a ministry. Wasn't any great Billy Graham revivals, wasn't like Nineveh where the people, where the entire city repented. Jeremiah preached for 40 years and was pretty much hated by everyone. His enemies, God said, would be your spiritual leaders, your political leaders, your own family, and your own people. And as we've gone through these first 38 chapters, we've found that exactly to be the case. Jeremiah was hated by his family. They spread rumors about him. They tried to destroy his reputation and credibility. They intimidated him. They bullied him. They beat him up. They tortured him. They put him in jail. They did everything they could. But they did not prevail over Jeremiah. He did not quit. He did exactly what God called him to do, and that's what we're called to do. Now, Jeremiah was the senior of these, what we call major prophets. These were all contemporaries, but Jeremiah was their older. When you learn the backgrounds of Daniel and Ezekiel, I am awfully sure, although I can't prove it, but I am awfully confident that Daniel and Ezekiel, as boys, 8, 10, 12 years of age, would have heard Jeremiah preaching the temple discourses there at the temple complex in Jerusalem. But of course, these are three major prophets. The city of Jerusalem fell over a period of 19 years. They lost control basically in 606 and became subservient to Nebuchadnezzar. They rebelled a little bit, and Nebuchadnezzar came back down and disciplined them, brought them back into line in 597. Then finally in 587, an 18-month siege was laid around the city, and the city was ultimately destroyed, the walls torn down, and the temple burned, the king's house burned, everything was burned. Now, Daniel was taken captive and served in the city of Babylon in Nebuchadnezzar's court. You know about Daniel. And Daniel in the lion's den, Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you know those stories. And then Ezekiel was taken captive in that second siege, or the middle siege, and he wound up ministering to a group of Jewish refugees in a community called Tel Aviv. That was the original Tel Aviv, about 50 miles south of Babylon on the Chebar River. And then Jeremiah, through this entire period of time, was left in Jerusalem ministering to his own people, again being hated, a largely fruitless ministry, we would say. And next week, or beginning with our next time we get together and study, we will see the post-conquest. We'll see Jeremiah left in the city ministering to those that were in fact left behind. Now here's where we are. We are right here at the very end. You see that white box that basically encompasses all of Jeremiah's ministry. It began in the 13th year of great King Josiah, who reigned for some 30, 31 years. So they were on the upswing of Josiah's 31-year reign of righteousness, as he was as a good king. And in the middle of that period of time, you've heard me reference it jokingly as like middle of the Reagan years. It'd be like having an evangelist being called in 1985 to go and preach repentance. Well, in 1985, it seemed like we were heading in a right direction. We had the moral majority and Jerry Falwell and everybody rocking and rolling. and we had a good president that looked out for the well-being of our country. We were working towards the fall of the wall in East Berlin, and things seemed to be on the uptick. Well, it was equivalent here when God called Jeremiah to begin his ministry. And he finished Josiah's reign, and then we see these other evil or squishy kings. Zedekiah wasn't as evil as he was squishy. He was easily manipulated, easily intimidated by his staff. And we are right here at the tail end. The city literally is under siege and about to fall, where we pick up in chapter 39. Chapter 39, verse 1. And in the ninth year of Zedekiah, the king of Judah, in the tenth month, came Nebuchadrezzar, king of Babylon, in all his army against Jerusalem. And they besieged it. And in the 11th year of Zedekiah, in the fourth month, the ninth day of the month, the city was broken up. Coincidentally, the same day here in 587, the same day, it's called Tish Abav, the same day in 70 AD, the temple was destroyed again, this time after Jesus was on this earth when the Romans conquered it. What a coincidence that is, that the temple was destroyed on the same day. They're, about 630 years apart, 640 years apart. This is significant because, as we've studied Ezekiel, we'll not take the time to cross-reference it tonight, but Ezekiel basically proved his authority or credibility as a prophet because he was butting his head against the wall with a bunch of Jews in captivity. And God revealed to him the day that the city was laid siege to. And Ezekiel said, write it down. Remember this day, because the city is falling. Well, of course, they didn't have internet back then. You didn't have, couldn't make a phone call or a cell phone. But a person escaped Jerusalem, made his way 500 miles to Babylon, and showed up after the city had been destroyed. And when they asked him, by the way, what day was the city destroyed? Well, it was on this day. And Jeremiah said, remember that note I told you to write down? That was the day. God told me. How would I know? 18 months? How would I know? Okay. So this day was significant. And the city was broken in. It says they came up to the northern part of the city. There's a mountain up north of the Temple Mount called Mount Scopus. It's got a great view of the city of Jerusalem. No doubt that was the headquarters of the invading general. And they ultimately used engines of war to breach the walls of Jerusalem. And they came in and broke through the north side. And all the princes of the king of Babylon came in and sat in the middle gate. Nergal-Sharezer, Samgar-Nebo, Sarshakim, Rab-Sarsus, Nergal-Sharezer, and Rab-Mag. Now, Rab-Sarsus and Rab-Mag are titles, not names. Be like calling me pastor. That would be a title. Rab-Sarsus meant the chief of the eunuchs. Rab-Mag, actually, interestingly, Daniel wound up assuming the role of Rab-Mag under the Assyrian Empire. So in the future, Daniel would become the chief of the Magi, or the magistrates, the counselor to the king. But here you've got these important political figures. Now notice the king's not here. Nebuchadnezzar is 100 miles away with his headquarters. But these princes all come in and set up court in one of the temple gates, one of the northern gates of the city. And it came to pass that when Zedekiah, the king of Judah, saw them, and all the men of war fled, and he tried to sneak out, went forth out of the city under the cover of night by way of the king's garden, by the gate between the two walls, and he went out the way of the plain. Now, you see up north, on the northern part, the top part of this picture, you see where Babylon came into the city. And they set up court. Basically, they took control. And the gates of the city is where much of the buying and selling would take place. Also, it was where the city council would meet, where the king would meet and actually rule and legislate. So they established their authority there in the gates of the city. Well, that night, Zedekiah tried to make a break for it. And just as we saw with our troops, when our troops were going into Iraq and going into Afghanistan, you'd go into a city. You know, you may have control of a city, but you haven't ferreted out every sniper or every bandit that's hiding throughout the course of the city. So that was the situation here. The Babylonians had taken control of the city. And by the way, 18-month siege. Understand what this is. They would surround you and starve you out. Rather than trying to tackle the walls and besiege the walls and breach the walls, they would just wait you out. You know, let me ask you this. How long could you make it at your house if you weren't able to leave your house? You know, you could make it for a while. You probably got a decent pantry. You know, some of you all that are preppers, you might be able to make it 3 months, 6 months, but eventually you're going to run out of food. Well, that was their situation. Eventually they ran out of food. They ran out of water. In fact, so was that for me? Back, eventually Jeremiah recorded in what's called his Lamentations, the Lamentations of Jeremiah. We know it as the Book of Lamentations. He talks about some of the things that were taking place. Literally, these princes and principal men, great wealthy men were giving handfuls of gold to buy a handful of bird excrement because they were so hungry, they were willing to eat excrement to keep from starving. Boy, God's got a way of humbling you, does he not? They were so hungry, good mothers were actually cooking their own children in order to survive. No water, no food. After 18 months of having a siege laid to the city where they were literally emaciated. Jeremiah talks about, looking like a concentration camp. What you would see, picture from pictures of Auschwitz, where people are just that hungry and that emaciated. It was at that point that they came in, breached the walls, took control of the city. Nevertheless, Zedekiah was hiding out. And he was hiding out in the southern part of the city, obviously as far away as the invaders as he possibly could. That night, he escaped to the south part. Now, you see in that red arrow down in the south, this is basically a view from the city of David, Mount Zion, looking south down the Kidron Valley. As you see that light yellow arrow, basically that's the viewpoint that you have from this picture. So you see the walls going up from the Kidron Valley up Mount Moriah to the city of David are very significant, very steep. So Zedekiah sneaks out with his private military guard. They make their way down Mount Moriah, across the Kidron Valley, up the Mount of Olives, which is that mountain you see on the left side of the screen there across the valley, and then down these mountains of Judea, about 3,000 feet to the Jordan River Valley. And the scripture tells us that he reached the Jordan River Valley by Jericho when all of a sudden the jig was up. So they had not ferreted out all the moles inside the city, but the Babylonians had taken it captive. Zedekiah tried to make a run for it, got this far, thinking that perhaps if he could get across the Jordan River, he might be able to find some refuge. But the Chaldean army pursued after them and overtook Zedekiah in the plains of Jericho. And when they had taken him, they brought him up to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, at Riblah, to the land of Hamath, where he gave judgment upon him. Now you see that red rectangle, that's Riblah. So this is 100 miles north of Jerusalem. And Zedekiah and his sons and his princes would have been taken, and they would have put hooks, literally like a fish hook, in their lips or through their noses and linked them together, like if you ever went to a circus where you'd see the elephants walking in a circle, but they're all kind of roped and linked together. That is how they would have been treated and led. You can see this artist's depiction in the lower left-hand corner, and you can see that's exactly the situation there as these hostages are now being captive and brought forward before the King of Kings, who was Nebuchadnezzar. And the Babylonians had conquered these other empires, and he was, in fact, the King of Kings. Then the king of Babylon himself slew the sons of Zedekiah and Riblah before his eyes, and also the king of Babylon slew all the nobles of Judah. Moreover, he put out Zedekiah's eyes and bound him with chains to carry him to Babylon. Now, you remember in recent weeks, one of the errors that Zedekiah's court thought that they had discovered was they thought there was a disagreement in the prophecies from Ezekiel, who was already in Babylon, and Jeremiah, who was there in Jerusalem. Because Jeremiah had said that Zedekiah is going to be carried off to Babylon. But Ezekiel said that Zedekiah would be carried off to Babylon, but he would never see Babylon. Huh, well, that's interesting. There must be something wrong. Both of these men profess to be prophets, but they don't agree with each other. Because Ezekiel clearly said that Zedekiah was not going to see Babylon, but Jeremiah says he's going to be carried off to Babylon. Well, in retrospect, we see that they were both exactly right. Zedekiah was told by Jeremiah, surrender, this judgment is from the Lord. Go off, you raise your families, you be good citizens, you're going into captivity for 70 years. And this is not that the Babylonians are conquering you. This is not that the gods of Babylon are greater than the God of Israel. Because that was the mental concept. They thought that our gods will demonstrate their superiority by victory in battle. So the strongest God had the strongest military. Well, that wasn't the situation at all. God's saying, first of all, there are no other gods. I'm it. And the reason that you, my people, are going to go into captivity is because of your disobedience. I've warned you. I've sent prophets. I've sent famines. I've sent droughts. I've done everything I know to do to get your attention. But you refuse to humble yourself and surrender yourself to me. Therefore, I'm taking you out of the land. By the way, in your history, you have ignored my sabbatical year of release to let the land rest 70 times. And I'm going to collect what you owe me. The land is going to rest for 70 years and you're going to be out of it. So I'm doing this to you, nobody else. Well, Jeremiah was preaching that message to Zedekiah. And he was saying, Zedekiah, surrender. If you surrender, everything's going to be okay. The people will live, everything will be fine. We'll be able to stay right here. We'll be subject to Nebuchadnezzar, but everything will be fine. His counselors wouldn't agree to it. They were expecting God to deliver them like he did Hezekiah 100 years earlier. What happened? Here they are at Riblah, standing before this king of kings, Nebuchadnezzar. The last thing Zedekiah saw with his eyes in this life was he saw his counselors all put to death, which they probably deserve for their bad counsel. Then he saw his sons, his heirs to the throne, put to death. And that was the last thing he ever saw. Then Nebuchadnezzar put his eyes out and led him away. And he died in captivity. So he did die in captivity in Babylon, but he did not, in fact, ever see the city of Babylon. So God always is very specific. God's prophecies aren't close. They're dead on accurate. That's why you hear me say such cockamamie, lame brain, insane things like, it wouldn't surprise me if the rapture didn't come on Rosh Hashanah. Because his first coming was perfect on the day of the type where the Passover lamb was staked out on the 10th of Nisan. Jesus made his triumphal entry into Jerusalem on the 10th of Nisan. He was observed for 4 days as the Passover lamb was to be observed for 4 days to make sure it was a lamb without spot or blemish. Well, for 4 days, Jesus came into the temple complex. Healed. First of all, he chased all the traitors out of the temple. Then healed and did great miracles. Then for 4 days, he withstood the questioning from the Pharisees, from the Sadducees, from the Herodians, you name it. And he trumped every one of them. And then at the end of it, boy, don't you love technology. Is that the speaker system? Okay, very good. Well, I'll try to talk through it. Then at the end of it, on the 14th, he was in fact declared to be a lamb without spot or blemish. As both Pilate and Herod testified, we find no fault with this man. And then on the 14th at Nisan is when he gave his life. On the 14th of Nisan at even is when the Passover lamb literally gave his life. So we see Christ's first coming fulfilling to the minute, really, what God had prophesied. Well, we've got the birth of the church in the Feast of Pentecost. The next thing on God's timetable is called Rosh Hashanah. That's the legal year, the beginning of the legal new year for the Jewish people. For 40 days leading up to it, they blow the shofar in the temple complex in preparation. On Rosh Hashanah, they blow the shofar 100 times, culminating in what the Jews call the last trump. which is also called, in fact, in the Bible, it's not referred to as Rosh Hashanah, it's referred to as Yom Teruah, which means the awakening blast. I don't know. Maybe I'm stretching. That's why I say that. Acts 17:11 is in the Bible telling you not to believe anything I tell you. But it wouldn't surprise me if on Rosh Hashanah is when the rapture happened. That would fit logically as I look at things. So that when I say God is specific, I think he is just that specific. By the way, just in case you want to know, Rosh Hashanah is September 6th through the 8th. And I don't know about you, but I'm 58, I'm tired, and I'm sick of the crap. Come on, Lord. If there were really 81 million people that voted for Joe Biden, and I don't believe that for a minute, I'd be surprised if 8 million people really voted for him. But if there are really 81 million people that want Joe Biden as president, you can have him. I'm ready to get out. I'm ready to take off. But in the meantime, we are not escapists. Looking to get out of here, we are working our tushies off for the glory of God, trying to point people to Jesus and withstand evil with every ounce and fiber of our bodies and all the gifts that God has entrusted to us. So Zedekiah, boy, things don't work out well for Zedekiah. And you can see there on the picture on the left, you can see that hook being hooked in his lip and Nebuchadnezzar holding him by that. And, of course, this is a depiction of Nebuchadnezzar himself putting his eyes out. Now, at the same time, or during while this is going on, while the king is escaping, the Chaldeans, of course, another name for the Babylonians. That was the region of Chaldea. Remember, Abraham was called out of Ur of the Chaldees. And the Chaldeans burned the king's house. Now, when the king gets his house burned, then you can assume that everybody on down had theirs burned as well. And the houses of the people with fire, and break down the walls of Jerusalem. The walls were the strength and the defense of a city. So basically, Jerusalem was finished as any kind of a political power or force at this point in time. Then Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, carried away captive unto Babylon the remnant of the people that remained in the city. In other words, those that did not die and those that fell away, that fell to him, or those that escaped and came over to Babylon with the rest of the people that remained. But Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, left of the poor of the people which had nothing in the land of Judah and gave them vineyards and fields at the same time. So we had a massive redistribution of wealth here. In fact, much of it was probably just because we have seen that was part of what Jeremiah's ministry was the evil that was taking place legally within the system. You know, they weren't following God's law at all. Let me ask you this. If we were actually doing what we were supposed to do as Christians, would it be necessary for us to have a police force? Would it be necessary for us to have lawyers? No. Would it be necessary for us to have security cameras in a store? Would it be necessary for us to really have detailed signed contracts with each other? No. If we were really living for the Lord the way we are supposed to be, then we would be honest, upright. Yeah, you can trust me to watch your kids, no problem. Oh, you need me to keep an eye on your house? No problem. Oh, you want me to keep your keys to your car, but you don't want me to drive it? No problem. We should be the most honest people of integrity that there are. Well, the Jews were calling themselves God's people, yet they were cheating and stealing and taking advantage of the poor, taking advantage of widows and orphans. By the way, that's the same thing that Jesus was rebuking the Pharisees for. They weren't taking care of the widows. They weren't taking care of their own parents because they were greedy and they were corrupt. Well, ultimately, all the people got hauled off to Babylon and the poorest were left to tend to the land of Israel. But Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, gave charge concerning Jeremiah to Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, saying, take him and look well to him and do him no harm, but do unto him even as he shall say unto thee. How did Nebuchadnezzar know about Jeremiah? Well, I think probably through Daniel. Because we know in Daniel chapter 9, for example, Daniel was puzzled over a letter that he had received from Jeremiah. Because Jeremiah said you're going to be in captivity for 70 years. And of course, Daniel's trying to balance this with the times of the Gentiles and the vision that he had had in chapter 7 and the vision that Nebuchadnezzar had in chapter 2. So Daniel was well aware and had correspondence back and forth with Jeremiah. And of course, Jeremiah was trying to convince Zedekiah to get in line, that God was bringing this judgment on the Jews because of their disobedience. So Nebuchadnezzar knew about Jeremiah, and no doubt Jeremiah was taken with all the other captives. No doubt Jeremiah was handcuffed and whatever, as I thought I might be last week at the DFW airport. Anyway, that's why I was texting all my lawyer friends, and Lash just laughed at me. He said, "I hope you go to jail." But anyway, I texted some lawyers that did love me, Matt Staver and Richard Mass, some other guys. So. But anyway, no doubt he was hauled off, and once he got up there to the disembarkation station in Riblah, and Nebuchadnezzar got everything settled, and Nebuchadnezzar said, "Oh, no, Jeremiah, he is a good man. He is free to go and do whatever he wants to. In fact, he can come with us to Babylon, or he can go back home, whatever he wants to do, but make sure he is well cared for." So Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, sent, and Nebush-Asban... I know some ass bands that are working at the Capitol. But I don't know if I know this Nebush. There's a reason we don't live stream on Wednesday nights. We take the film and we edit it down to what we actually put out in the public. And in here, it's my word against yours. So I never said that. What do you mean? Even they sent and took Jeremiah out of the court of the prison, committed unto Gedaliah, who was the new governor of Judea underneath Nebuchadnezzar, the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, that he should carry him home, so he dwelt among the people. Now the word of the Lord came unto Jeremiah while he was shut up. So this was earlier on. This is before the city fell. You remember the last chapter. There was an Ethiopian minister of the court, an Ethiopian eunuch, that took care of Jeremiah. When he was in a pit in prison, and rescued him. And God told Jeremiah to tell this Ethiopian eunuch that he was going to be spared and taken care of. So now we've seen Jeremiah's been taken up to Riblah. Now in reflection, as Jeremiah is heading back to Judah, we see a summary of some of the other events that took place. Remember, the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah when he was shut up in prison, saying, "Go and speak to Ebed-Melech, the servant of the king, the Ethiopian, saying, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, Jehovah Sabaoth, the Lord of armies, God of Israel. Behold, I will bring my words upon this city for evil and not for good. I'm going to punish this city. And they shall be accomplished in that day, and you're going to see it before thee. But I will deliver thee, Ebed-Melech, you servant of the king, saith the Lord. And thou shalt not be given into the hand of the men to whom thou art afraid, for I will surely deliver thee. Thou shalt not fall by the sword. You're not going to be killed. You're not going to die in the famine, but thy life shall be given you as a prey, as a reward, as a ransom, because thou hast put thy trust in me, saith the Lord." That brings us to an end to chapter 39. Now, beginning in chapter 40, we're going to go into a different phase. No longer is there a king. Zedekiah is now done. But Nebuchadnezzar has left this man named Gedaliah as governor of the area. Jeremiah has chosen to stay in Judah rather than have a pretty good life in Babylon as a favored, captured individual. And the king, Nebuchadnezzar, gave him a stipend. I don't know how much, but they gave him money. They gave him safe travel. He's headed back to Judah, to Jerusalem, and he was free to go and do as he pleased. We will pick up next time with the rule of Gedaliah and some of the problems that they had there. And again, disobedience by the Jewish people, and again, further problems. We'll get into chapter 51 and 52, which will be prophetic, dealing with the city of Babylon. There is discussion as to whether those events have actually happened yet. There's a good argument to say that they have, and there, I think, a better argument to say that they haven't been completely fulfilled, but we will cover that when we get there. We've got about 10 weeks. You all can be thinking about what you want to cover next after we get through Jeremiah. We've got about 10 weeks, and we will wrap this up. Now, we're going to segue into a time of prayer here, and we're going to take about 10 minutes to pray. But as we do, I had received this week through some email or something, maybe it's a social media post, I don't know what it was, but a statement that was made by C.S. Lewis. Of course, C.S. Lewis was a wonderful Christian apologist, and he was an Englishman. And he was a member of the Church of England, and he was truly a born-again believer, wonderful apologist. If you've not read the book, Mere Christianity, I highly recommend it to you. It is a great apologetic. But he was actually hired by the King of England to give daily radio broadcasts to the English people during the Battle of Britain, when London was being bombed every night by the Nazis. C.S. Lewis was called to minister to the British people and encourage them spiritually during this time of great crisis. Well, after the war, 1948, the atomic age had begun. Of course, any of you that are young people, if you've ever heard anybody trash America, understand that you go all the way back to Nebuchadnezzar, go all the way back to Nimrod in Genesis 9 and 10. Evil man has always wanted to rule the world. I personally believe that George Soros and Bill Gates are some of those men that want to rule the world today. I wouldn't be surprised if they weren't two of those 10 horns of Daniel 7 or 10 toes of Daniel 2. I kind of suspect that they are, but men like them want to rule the world. Well, there's been one country that could have ruled the world. In 1945, we had more military. We had greater military might. We were rolling at that time. We had just gone to war on two fronts and defeated both Germany and Imperial Japan. We could have owned the world if we wanted to. In fact, good counsel, General Patton. Patton said, while we got everybody under arms, we just need to go ahead and take care of Russia right now because they are not our friends. He was right. Bunch of communists, they were not our friends. But we were the only country on the planet that had the atomic bomb. If we wanted to rule the world, we could have, but we didn't. Instead, we invested and we rebuilt the world and we sent missionaries into the world. And our boys came home. So don't let anybody at school ever tell you that America is an evil imperialistic nation. America is not perfect. Every nation has flaws. And in our history, you'll find flaws. But there has not been one nation ever in history that has been better than the United States of America. We truly have been an exceptional nation. So when we have such nightmares as what's going on with this fraud who's in the White House right now, it's a disgrace to the United States of America. And I pray that I know that justice will come at the great white throne. I know that Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer and Joe Biden and Gates and all of these, what was the term? Ash bands? What was the name? I forget. Will one day stand before the Lord at the great white throne and they'll get theirs. I would love to see it now, and I hope it happens now. But C.S. Lewis, during this time of great fear, the atomic age, there was a threat in any day that Russia, who now had the atomic bomb, would launch and, well, mutually assured destruction. During the late 40s and 50s, much of the world lived in fear. People had bomb shelters in their backyard. C.S. Lewis said this, and I want us to remember it now as they are attempting to paralyze us with fear over this virus and the Delta variant and the Zeta variant and every other variant that's out there. In one way, it says, on living in the atomic age, in one way, we think a great deal too much of the atomic bomb. I would insert COVID-19. How are we to live in a COVID-19 age? I am tempted to reply, why? As you would have lived in the 16th century when the plague visited London almost every year. Or as you would have lived in a Viking age when raiders from Scandinavia might land and cut your throat any night. Or indeed, as you are already living in an age of cancer. Anybody can relate to that one? Yep, an age of cancer. An age of syphilis, an age of paralysis, an age of air raids, an age of railway accidents, an age of motor car accidents. In other words, do not let us begin by exaggerating the novelty of our situation. Believe me, dear sir or madam, you and all whom you love were already sentenced to death before the atomic bomb was invented. Ladies and gentlemen, if the Lord doesn't come first, every one of us are going to die at some point. We just don't know when or how. But death is certain. And quite a high percentage of us were going to die in unpleasant ways. We had indeed one very great advantage over our ancestors, anesthetics. And we have that still. It is perfectly ridiculous to go about whimpering and drawing long faces because the scientists have added one more chance of painful and premature death to a world which already bristled with such chances and in which death itself was not a chance at all, but a certainty. This is the first point to be made, and the first action to be taken is to pull ourselves together. If we are all going to be destroyed by COVID-19, then let it find us doing sensible and human things like praying and working and teaching and reading and listening to music and bathing the children and playing tennis and chatting to our friends over a pint. In fact, we might have to become Church of England if this goes on much longer. This non-drinking stuff as Baptists is getting old. In fact, Cindy said to me last Sunday when we were spending 8 hours in the Admiral Club and drinks for free, she said, you know, this wouldn't be as bad as if we were drinking. And at least they would have had justification for throwing us all at the airplane. But we weren't even misbehaving, so I don't know. All right, and a pint and a game of darts, not huddled together like frightened sheep with our masks on. Social distancing in our basements and thinking about COVID-19. Ladies and gentlemen, if it wasn't for the news, I wouldn't even have known that COVID-19 existed this year. They may break our bodies. A microbe can do that. Very astute observation by C.S. Lewis. That's what we're battling right now. But they need not dominate our minds. All right. That being said, we gave $5,000 today to the Nazarene Fund. We'll give more than that if necessary. We gave $1,000 out of Black Robe Regiment. We gave $1,000 out of Reclaiming America for Christ. I've committed some money. Dan's committed some money. Figure we'll make up the balance with a love offering either tonight or whenever you want to stick it in the box. By the way, this isn't your tithes and all. Tithes go to fund the church and our ministry. Offerings or whatever the Lord lays upon your heart to give. And by the way, Dan Davis made this observation the other day. He said, Pastor, I've never heard you preach on tithing. And he's right, I've probably done you a disservice. But I've always been afraid that somebody would wander in, visit our church one Sunday when I'm preaching on tithing, and they think, there's none of those Baptist preachers always looking for money. Well, that's not what we do. I have approached it from the perspective that if your heart's right, everything else is going to come into order. Your sex life, your habits, your hobbies, your giving, it's going to all come into order. I've just let the Lord take care of that. And it has. Our church has been blessed. For a church our size, we do amazing things because the Lord is doing some amazing things through us. But anyway, we committed. And if you want to contribute towards that, just drop it in the donation boxes that we have at the front and the back. But this is an organization that was set up by Glenn Beck. Glenn is a Mormon. I've been on his program a number of times. Dan has been on his program a number of times. I think he's a great guy. I in no way endorse or adhere to Mormonism. Fundamental Mormonism is not fundamental Christianity. But there are a lot of Mormons that are great people, including Glenn, and he is a great patriot. I very much have no problem. In fact, I sent this out to all of our pastors' network, encouraging them to join up as well. I have no problem working with him in this effort because they are actively hiring planes right now. They figure there's up to 5,000 that they need to get out. The cost to do this, chartering these planes, is $4,000 a person. So this is going to be about a $20 million venture. Glenn donated the first 100. We put in 5. People are already all of them contributing to this. Now think about this. Has anybody in here ever seen the movie Schindler's List? Go home and watch it. Watch it tonight if you can. Oscar Schindler was a German that did his best. He literally broke himself trying to buy the safety of Jews and get them to escape rather than going to the concentration camps. Folks, we've got it. Things are getting tougher, but it's not exactly tough for us yet. All of us are blessed. If we had the ability, if we could look across and see eye to eye with somebody, and if we knew that we could save their lives from martyrdom for $4,000, I think if we could see them personally, we'd probably bankrupt ourselves trying to save as many as we can. Well, that's the situation. So, you know, we've committed five. We may commit more. You know, if you all feel like contributing to this, please join us. We're going to be involved in it. We have about 48 hours. And then you see how quickly things are coming apart over there.